You are super tiny and had just been picked up off the street by a truck driver. Let's turn the page now. He brought you to Broadway Animal Clinic, and you were so cute and so tight. What do you mean? You've heard this before. Well, fine. I guess we're done with the Snuggles memory book for now. Such a typical teenager. Welcome back, cool cats and cat allies alike, to 6 Degrees of Cats, the world's best and only cat-themed culture, history, and science podcast. Not a day goes by where I don't wonder what is going on in the walnut-sized brains of my little children, or my co-executive producers, Binky and Snuggles. Partly because we can't speak to each other, true. There's body language and tells. You know, I've read all the books. The ears, the tails, the fur raised, the vocalisms like hissing and meowing. But what goes on behind Binky's big golden eyes when his pupils dilate? Did he just remember something from his childhood? Or Snuggles? I can definitely sense the PTSD. And it breaks my heart. As well as the fixation on cardboard. What's up with that, Snug? Might it have to do with Snuggles' last minutes of her mom and siblings before she was extracted from the side of the road that fateful day and adopted? Wait a minute. It just occurred to me. Snuggles, Binky, and I don't know who our biological parents are. We're all adopted. And in this season 2 finale of 6 Degrees of Cats, family is the watchword. We're going to take a closer look at family. And of course, these little adoptees we've brought into our homes, hearts, and our families. So, buckle up, listeners. It's time to get a little more personal. In 2012, researchers found that there were more American households with pets than kids, meaning there are more people in this country whose children have fur, feathers, or scales than, human skin. And yet, try telling that to HR if your time-off policy precludes pet care, or heaven forbid, pet bereavement. Or justifying your cat's photo in your wallet to your college bestie's flavor of the month at happy hour, who is that guy that decides it's comedy hour and you're the sucker who happens to be a lady with cats sitting right next to him.
And he has a YouTube channel.
Great. Don't even try it with the U.S. Census Bureau or the IRS. Neither count pets as dependents. I may or may not speak from experience. What was I saying? Right. Family. That's a word that either sends shivers down your spine, delight in your heart, or perhaps something ambiguous or in between. What's that thing Trotsky said about families? Maybe you feel like you have family, they just aren't related to you. Or maybe you feel like you just haven't found them yet. Either way, there's no escaping the impact of family, or lack thereof. According to the UN, family is the fundamental group unit of society, and claiming a family or being claimed by a family is a huge part of our identities. I guess that's why there are so many plays, dramas, songs, and stories about families. The more I say the word family, the more I realize just how amorphous that word is. Here on the human side of things, it's said casually in conversation. You know, cat family, hey fam, that kind of thing. So, let's dig into the word. There's the family, capital T, capital F. You know,
the mafia.
Or cults, be they corporate or religious.
We're like family here.
Run, don't walk when you hear that in a job interview. Or on the street. Seriously, true story. The Family International, formerly known as the Children of God cult, repeatedly tried to recruit me as a member when I lived in Tokyo. I have have no idea what about me screams nonconformist who is open to weird stuff. Whatever. Oh, and of course, the family. As in, parents, kids, aunts, uncles, cousins, the court jester, the family frog. Since this word has a variety of applications these days, let's get on the same page here. As in, what's on the page when you look up F for family? Here it is. Oh, etymology. I love bugs. What's this say? Brian, take it away.
Family is from late Middle English and also from Latin, familia, for household servants or family, from famulus, servant, to denote the servants of a household or the retinue of a nobleman.
Well now, that certainly adds a spin on the origin. As for the definition here.
A group of people consisting of one set of parents and their children, whether living together or not. In wider sense, any group of people connected by blood, marriage, adoption, etc.
That's more or less what I expected. And, you know, it leaves a lot of people out. What defines those connections? How come it's just people? Who came up with this anyway? I am not the first to notice this. Heck, there's a whole field of research dedicated to studying the family.
Human development and family studies at the time science now.
And I was fortunate to have consulted one such expert to understand the tiny telenovela of our lives. La familia, the family.
So my name is Carol Johnston. Human development and family science is what my master's and PhD are in. I'm on faculty at Kansas State University in the Department of Applied Human Sciences. I started looking at what happens when family changes, not necessarily the family structure itself, but is it changing a lot? So is there a lot of turnover in who's in the household and how that affects children over time? And that to me became very fascinating and is really the core of what I do today.
As Dr. Johnston's work alludes, the concept of the family as two parents and kids, etc., is up for serious reexamination. To start,
think about the different family structures. Like, I think even today, people would say that the ideal family structure is a two-parent biological family home, right? And that's actually not the case. Before, you know, we have what we think of as the nuclear family, it could be that grandparents or a grandparent was really the head of the household, or it could be that the parents who are kind of what we would call now the sandwich generation were the head of the household.
Thanks, Dr. Johnston. This was true in the 17th century when the colonists from Europe arrived on North American shores, then known as Turtle Island. Those folks quickly stole from those 50 to 100 million people who called this continent home at the time, that are now collectively referred to as Native Americans, who they then drove, trafficked, or murdered off the land, and then got to work harvesting the riches of this new world through real estate development, trade, and of course, agriculture. And it's at this point where I think the genesis of the nuclear family story we're told can be traced, down on the farm. Dr. Johnston takes the floor.
At the time, multiple generations of families were living basically on farms and helping out in whatever way they could. When they were working on the farm, for example, children would go from children very quickly to helpers. They had more children because the more children, the more help that there was. And the Industrial Revolution really was one of the biggest movements away from that larger extended family to the smaller family that is more prevalent today. A lot of that had to do with people moving to big cities, getting jobs that weren't on the farm and things like that, and being able to really have the money to support a family without being on the family farm like had been in the past, where adults could make a living in cities doing 9-to-5 work, essentially.
The good old days, where you weren't always on...
Actually, I don't think it was 9 to 5 at the time. It was more like 12 hours a day.
Never mind.
Interestingly, the average age of marriage also dropped during that same time, the late 19th and early 20th centuries, but has increased in recent decades. So what we saw was when men and women were going to the city and they weren't with their families, they were alone. And so they started marrying earlier instead of later.
Fascinating. I thought that would lead to people delaying marriage. What else transformed?
As we saw smaller families, we started to see this developmental period of adolescence that wasn't always there.
Adolescence. From workers in the house to slackers.
In some cases.
Sleeping and eating a lot, mood swings, making messes, getting away with it. And, of course, they're always around if you need someone to give an unsolicited opinion. That kind of sounds like my cats. So, about this industrial revolution. You know, Ford's Model T car and the introduction of the assembly line manufacturing process, which kicked off the huge global supply chain. This transformation relieved U.S. families from the hard work of being basically a one-home factory, making everything from food to clothes to homes by hand. From scratch. You'd think this whole mass production system designed for surplus would then allow for everyone to be comfortable and have food and not suffer through the winter worrying about how to keep a roof over their head and the heat on. You know, so people could rest. To live like a house cat. Well, you done thought wrong.
The shift really favors the wealthy and really hurts the working class in a lot of ways. We don't have a lot of social resources for families in the U.S. We don't have universal childcare. It just doesn't give parents and women the option, right? I have a friend who his wife, it is cheaper for her to stay home with their children than for her to work because childcare for her to work was more than her salary.
What happens when you don't buy into that and choose to be, say, a childless woman with a cat?
When that nuclear family came about in the 1950s, 60s, there was a stigma. People who were single and adults were seen as weird or different.
Keeping the family nuclear has literally been a political platform to divide classes, masquerading as, of course, morals and national security. Case in point, ex-president Richard Nixon, who quashed the first national child care bill, which passed in both the Senate and the House because it would have made us all communists or something. What a win. Seriously, look it up. Well, folks, nothing seems to be run on logic or actual real data in this tragically flawed nation full of beautiful families of all shapes, sizes, and admixtures. I'm so glad we're taking the time to redefine the American family, and we're going to continue talking about this with another expert after the break.
Welcome, baby.
Aww, she's so cute.
Is that a birthmark or a tail?
I think it's time to
But will she ever learn to speak English?
That was my great-aunt Bertha, R.I.P., on her grandniece, yours truly, who'd arrived just weeks prior from Seoul, South Korea, by way of Detroit International Airport. Aunt Bertha, God bless her. Born in the early 20th century, Aunt Bertha was raised during the Great Depression, the youngest daughter in a relatively small family of seven. Aunt Bertha was one of those uncredited heroes of the Great Generation who never married or had kids and got stuck staying at home, providing free elder care for their parents, which allowed her siblings to build wealth Nursing homes cost a fortune, y'all. As you may have guessed, I don't think she was able to get out much. Obviously, yes, yours truly did learn to speak English. Before you guffaw at what a silly, uneducated person Aunt Bertha must have been, remember, only relatively recently have we begun to appreciate the language acquisition genius brains that babies possess. Before Piaget and Pinker, folks thought babies were a tabula rasa, a blank slate onto which all knowledge of the world was to be manually inscribed by their elders. By that logic, I can see why it wouldn't seem as obvious that languages were teachable. And, quite frankly, our systems reinforce this because there is still a strong overbias for biology when it comes to family. I'm reminded of this on a pretty regular basis.
Thanks for coming to see me, Amanda.
You're welcome.
So, about this growth you're concerned about, you wrote something about it looking like the Virgin Mary, and if we can corroborate that on the record. The answer is no, but it is an odd shape. Does anyone else in your family have a history?
I don't know my biological family's history. I'm adopted. I wrote it on the
form. So you don't have any records of your family medical history?
Yeah, I guess that's how that works.
Oh, okay. I guess we'll never know what it is then. It'll probably kill you. Oh, and your insurance doesn't cover this exam, so that'll be $3,000 payable at the front desk. Sherry can help you.
It's been like this for the past 26 years. The medical industrial complex has a lot of room for improvement, but it seems like a pretty quick win to just, well, adapt the questions already. Because no, the word family should not intrinsically translate to genetic relatives.
I absolutely do not think families have to be genetically related to be considered family. Absolutely not. There's the census, U.S. government definition, which is by blood or marriage or common law or whatever that may be. But I think that practically, logistically, day in and day out of our lives, that there are so many examples of people who step in to those familial roles in many different ways, which may change along the way. There's a class I teach where I always ask, what qualifies as a family? And it's often mother, father, sister, brother, and friends. Also, when you think about a neighborhood, that's family in many ways, helping each other when we're in need. You see a lot of community in oppressed groups. They have to rely on each other because the systems weren't built for them. There's this community that's created that really steps in for family, for resources. They have a very strong fictive kin network.
Fictive kin, in other words,
I like the term people are using more currently now, chosen family. Who is your chosen family? Because we have family that we may be tied to based on bloodlines. We have families of experience that we may have grown up with that may or may not be tied to us through bloodlines. And we have people that we choose to call our family that we may not have grown up with and we may or may not have blood ties to.
That was a friend of mine who has literally known me since infancy and also happens to have the bona fides to supplement Dr. Johnston's expertise on family.
I am Dr. Katie Bozak. I am a licensed marriage and family therapist. I have been providing mental health services to kids, families, couples, adults, anyone who needs mental health services for the past 14 years. I am also the executive director of the Korean American Adoptee Adoptive Family Network, also known as CAN. I am the first Korean adoptee in this position in the history of CAN. And I've been in that role since 2018.
The history of Korean adoption, part of my history, ties into a lot of what I covered with Dr. Johnston.
international Korean adoptions began in 1953 with the Holt family. After the Korean War, they adopted 8 Korean children, and they got so much press that that is really what started it off. And a lot of those early adoptions were kids who were mixed-race Koreans, Amerasian and Black Korean kids.
Cohorts shaped by the same lack of resources that Dr. Johnston and I discussed earlier.
There are so many layers, not just post-war, but also the influence of religion and the church's involvement. I was always told, oh, your mom was probably young and couldn't take care of you. Or your parents were too poor and couldn't take care of you. That is not true. Those are easy answers. And it's not looking at all of the other layers that contribute to how 250,000 of children have been adopted out of Korea since the 1950s. The layers are economic, social, they're international politics, there's religion. So the adoptions were starting post-war, and now we have this boom in babies with unwed moms. At least for me, the time period when I was adopted, there's more factory work. More people from the rural areas were moving into the bigger cities, which then meant more cohabitation and unwed pregnancies. And then put on the patriarchal nature of society then. What do we do?
While it does have its roots in altruism, adoption is an individual, imperfect, band-aid solution for a systemic problem that leads children to be removed from the people, places, and resources that inform on so many fundamental aspects of their identities. It is a trauma to separate a child from their homes, their ancestors, and their cultures, especially given the critical intergenerational kinship networks that naturally form among blood relatives. There's a lot more to say about the many intersecting complexities about transracial, transnational adoption, but I'll just say, as with blood and DNA, paperwork that gives the baby a new name and new parents does not a family make.
Adoptees have a mom, dad, extended family, but that doesn't get at the quality of relationship. That is based on the work that you put into how you relate to one another and building that relationship, not just on those titles. What makes a family is a very individual question that we all have to ask ourselves. Who do we consider family? Why do we consider them family? And just that personal question of, to me, what does being a family mean? Just because you are quote-unquote family, that's the title, does not necessarily mean you enjoy spending time with them. I know lots of people in work and outside of work who do not want to go back home for the holidays. They don't want to spend time with family because they are not the ones who are supportive, encouraging, and loving in the ways that they need or want. Think about the rise in celebrating Friendsgiving, having a holiday with your chosen family, the people that you would want to be around, in addition to the quote-unquote traditional family holiday. So I think we are moving towards just that idea of those who we can count on, who support us, who encourage us, who love us in the ways that we need and want, not just based on title. Too often we talk about family as, who's your real family, right? I don't want to say real because, again, going back to the adoptive narrative of, who are your real parents? My parents who adopted me are still real. They're not fake. They're not figments of my imagination, right? But who's my genuine family? Who's my authentic family? Who is the family that I choose to surround myself with and call family? Those are the people that validate my experience and affirm what I'm saying. They're the ones who are supporting me, who I know I can share who I am, if that makes sense.
You know, adoptive families themselves are not well studied. There's a dearth of literature on adoptive family dynamics in comparison to blood families.
We have a lot of anecdotal stories, and there's certainly been some research done in the early 90s, but there's just not a large body of research on adoptions, particularly from a family science or family sociology perspective.
We do, however, have a lot on adoptees themselves, or ourselves. We adoptees have long been used in observational and experimental psychology as research subjects, especially in any research investigating the age-old question of nature versus nurture, a field now called epigenetics.
Epigenetics is looking at the interaction of the environment or nurture and genetics or nature, where nurture turns on that nature gene, right? And so something in the environment helps grow or encourage something that might occur more naturally. An adoptee, they still have those genetics that are being interacted with this new environment that they're in. Those epigenetics may play out differently for adoptees versus children who are with their biological parents. And so I think that then when you think about nature versus nurture, so much of it is what of those natural inclinations do we see and then do we encourage as they grow? Whether that's finding community or building up different talents.
So it's so interesting that like this musical baby was adopted by this visually creative mom. My mom is more of a introvert. I'm more of an extrovert, clearly, but it meshes so well. So while I don't carry her introvertedness, I can understand people on that level because of her, which is great. Her desire to stay involved in her community has really rubbed off on me because I love to be involved in my community.
That was our friend, fellow podcaster and actor, Melissa Victor.
Also known as Melly, I am the host and creator of a kid podcast called Stoop Kid Stories. I work in kid podcasting by day, and I'm a musical theater performer at night.
So much of Melly's podcast addresses, well, family and how to make people feel included and welcomed. All vital parts of truly feeling with and among family, which Melly and I discussed.
The first thing that comes to mind when I think of family is belonging. I don't need blood to be like, that's my family. You know, the idea of chosen family. We see church family. You see your school family. Like, who do you belong to? Who are you connected to? Who do you care about 110%? Who do you love 110%? And it doesn't even have to be blood. What communities do you want to insert yourself in that unconditional love and care and support?
Like Katie and I, Melly is also adopted, but there's one significant difference in her family story. Her mother and her biological family were already connected through geography and racial identity.
I'm not a transracial adoptee. I was born in Baltimore, and I've been with my mom since I was 7 days old. She was approached in church, and she's like, oh, okay, I can foster a kid. I think in the state of Maryland, I couldn't legally get adopted until I was like 4 or 5. So then around, I want to say 6 years old, I was like, mommy, I want a little sister. Like, God, send me a little sister. And then the social worker called and said, hey, Ms. Victor, Melissa's biological mom had another kid. Would you be open to adopting her as well? And she turns to me, she says, do you want a little sister? Of course, I say, yes. So I got to grow up with my biological sister. I do not share my mother's blood, but I share so many other things. If there's a list of 100 things and blood is number one, I share 99 of those things. I always say you look like the people that feed you. The unconditional love and care and support that is between the three of us is unmatched. I belong to my mom, I belong to my sister. I belong in this family.
I love that. Whether by nature or nurture. Like Melly, I do, in some ways, look like the ones who fed me. I smile and speak exactly like my mom, per my friend Yuki. And when friends who see me at my best notice just how grounded and pragmatic I can be, I attribute that to both of my parents. On the other side of things, though, I was definitely the black sheep. Still am. The cats, the music, Weird Al. Things that are intrinsically part of who I am. But my folks showed themselves to be genuine family to this scrappy little Cabbage Patch kitten by celebrating and supporting my quirks. Thanks, Ma and Pa Kitten. My real parents. My genuine kin. But enough about me. At this point, we've come far in this kitty family investigation. In my research, I came upon a really great article in LitHub examining the word family across a diversity of cultures and languages. The common thread wasn't blood or the structure. It was the sharing of a domicile, a safe and warm place to call home.
I was actually talking to a vet friend of mine this week, and one thing she mentioned to me that I thought was just fascinating, and it's so true, is that really it's only been in the last 25, 30 years they've created these great medications to make sure that our animals don't have fleas and ticks. Cats can be in the house all the time. So I think because they are more indoor now and can be indoor more often, they are seen more as a part of the family.
Well, friends, or should I say fam, since we well established that this quote-unquote nuclear family is total fiction, I hereby declare that anyone who you mutually hold in your heart and welcome into your home, definitely our cats, counts as a full-fledged member of the fam. And if you need me to write a strongly worded note to your manager justifying your PTO request to take Mr. Whiskers to the vet, call on me or send them this episode. My case for including cats as full-fledged family, not as visitors, not as pets, but truly genuine chosen family. Family. When I call you family and I become yours, your kin becomes mine. We're all just 6 or less degrees apart in that way. We are all now each other's family. And that's our cats, too. Y'all, when I gaze upon the faces of my son and my daughter,
biological, obviously,
it makes me feel so lucky. What a blessing to have adopted these two. Hey, Snugs? Okay, fine. Next time, you write the episode closing. All right, we tried that in season 1. Thumbs. I can't believe we've arrived at our final destination this season. Thank you so much for joining us on SS 6 Degrees of Cats. Talk about a trip. The team and I had such a blast, and we really appreciate the kind notes, emails, reviews, and of course, the interactions on social media and on our Substack. Please keep them coming. We'll be taking a break for a few months, preparing for the launch of season 3 with a fresh roster of passengers from the worlds of academia, the arts, and the sciences with our usual unique take on the world through, of course, cat-eyed glasses. Please keep on following us on all the social media channels. We're at 6 Degrees of Cats. Number 6, please. And of course, keep the podcast app fresh because we're going to be popping in here and there with announcements and extras. The best way to stay on top of things is to subscribe to the Companion newsletter, which is our mailing list. So until then, I want to thank my wonderful experts,
Carol Johnston,
Katie Bozak,
and
Melissa Victor.
While the opinions are my own, the research and work is theirs. If you'd like to learn more about them, please check out our show notes, which also include the references and research that went into this episode. If you loved it, please shout it from the rooftops. Write your local officials. Recommend it to your favorite mailing lists or famous people or folks who are looking to give away money to intrepid podcasters with cats, like me. And we're always grateful for the kind of comments and 5-star ratings you're leaving in those podcast apps. That's super helpful, and we appreciate that. But most of all, we appreciate you. Thank you so much, dear listeners. To paraphrase one of our favorite songs, we are family. Because as y'all know by now, everything is connected. 6 Degrees of Cats is produced, written, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Captain Kitty, a.k.a. Amanda B. Please subscribe to our mailing list by going to linktr.ee/6degreesofcats or look us up on all those social media platforms. You'll be first in line for the extra audio and more treats if you connect with us there. All episodes are dedicated to the misunderstood, the marginalized, the resilient, and the weird. And of course, all the cats we've loved and lost.
We don't have a cat or a dog. We have a hedgehog.
They are nocturnal, so she's more active in the evening time. She eats a mixture of cat food. You're going to have to do like a combined hedgehog-cat podcast.